This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Mars, for generations making chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. Well, today it's wine authority Jancis Robinson. That name may not ring a bell for Americans, but for the British wine establishment, she's a force to be reckoned with. We talk about how tight money could actually be a good thing for wine lovers. Jennifer McLaughlin's cookbook, Fat, is a reminder of what we've been missing in the flavor department. Competitive eaters square off over plates of spinach. Our reporter delivers the blow-by-blow. And as always, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now, you can reach us at 800-537-5252 or online at splendidtable.org. But right now, let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern, authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late.
Lynn, we just got back from Charleston, South Carolina, and we found a bounty of great places. But probably our favorite was Dave's Carryout, which is a little fry shop. Michael, is that a term we can coin?
I would call it that, yes.
Yeah, that fried shrimp. It's got 2 tables, 3 tables, and it's really one of the soul food restaurants in Charleston, South Carolina. But rather than classic soul food, it's fried seafood.
Well, and also fried pork chops and French fries, and they all get fried in the same oil.
Now, Lynn, do you know about the frying of Charleston, South Carolina?
I know about it only from experience of being there and talking to John Martin Taylor, you know,
yes,
who is the food guy who is native to that area.
He was the first one who clued us in on this probably 6 or 7 years ago. He took us to the now defunct Edisto Motel for the absolutely perfect fried shrimp. And it is really true that the fried whatever in that area, well, I should say fried seafood, not the pork chops, is like none other anywhere else in this country. It is so, it's almost like tempura. It's very brittle, fragile, beautiful frying, not a big wad of dough.
And of course, the shrimp are fresh. I mean, they're like local fresh shrimp, so they really have a snap to them, which is great. And the thing about Dave's Carryout, and it is mostly carryout, and in fact, those tables are usually occupied by people waiting for their carryout order, is that it just moved about 2 or 3 years ago, and it used to be famous for, how can I put this?
The fashion show that goes on there?
The 3 a.m. fashion show.
3 a.m.?
Yes. Dave's officially closes, I believe, at midnight. However, unofficially, it usually stays open, especially on weekends, practically until dawn. And what you see at maybe 2, 3, 4 in the morning are people from Charleston having left sometimes very swanky parties in full dress attire, arriving in really snazzy cars to get, you know, pounds of fried shrimp to eat at, you know, to end the evening.
I saw the best hats that I've ever seen anywhere. I mean, are you aware of church hats,
yes,
that African-American ladies wear on Sunday?
Fabulous. They are fabulous.
Well, this is like, I mean, it would put all the, you know, like Queen Elizabeth and all the people who wear those giant hats to shame. I mean, this is a parade of hats and fried shrimp. And in my book, it doesn't get any better than that.
This sounds fabulous. Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you know you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, also check out our other examples of vital, essential, life-changing information. Our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our podcasts, recipes, and information on our book. how to eat supper, recipes, stories, and opinions. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Fat is like the forbidden lover, like that secret affair we sneak trysts with bacon and butter burgers. Some of us have even been known to order pork belly for dessert. Now, this may seem to go against our collective health concerns, but I think that we've missed the point about fat. Little else opens up flavors the way fat does, and a tad will actually do the job. Canadian food writer Jennifer McLaughlin is way ahead of me on this one. Her latest book is Fat, An Appreciation of a Misunderstood Ingredient with Recipes. Jennifer, it's good to have you back.
Thank you, Lynn. It's great to be here.
You've got some great stories in the book about the history of fat. One I found really interesting was about the British in India in the 19th century. It was in the 1800s.
That's right. In the 1800s, there was what was known later as the Indian Mutiny. And this really, fat wasn't the main reason there was a mutiny. There was a problem with the British rule and the East India Company. But what happened is that the British had a lot of Indians working for them, Hindus and Muslims. And they brought in this new rifle, and it had a cartridge, and they had to bite the cartridges and put the cartridge into the rifle. That's mm-hmm. how it worked. But to make this simpler for the cartridge to go into the rifle easily, the cartridges were greased. And they were greased with a mixture of beef fat and pork fat. That was so the British couldn't have done it worse. They put both the fats that were the Muslims didn't want the pork fat and the Hindus didn't eat any beef products. So this fired up a huge rebellion in the army, in the regular soldiers, and the British just said, well, if you don't like it, you can grease them with some kind of vegetable oil yourself. But it was a spark that triggered the rest. It was just like the final straw for this mm-hmm. rebellion.
You mentioned in this story, too, that the East India Company was this incredibly profitable project, and it's what originally brought the British to India, and that revolt essentially ended the East India Company. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct, because it became such a mess, the government had to take it over, and so which eventually led to the independence of India.
Huh.
So
let's talk about fat in the kitchen. Now, the types of fat. Now, from the point of view of flavor, the great fats to use. You talk a lot about suet, and I think for people in British cultures, they know what that's about. But could you explain what suet is?
Yes, certainly, because it's funny. When I mention suet here, most people say birds, and I go, birds? I think of mincemeat and steamed pudding, but obviously a lot of people in bird feeders in the winter, there's a mixture of suet amongst the seeds. And suet is a fat. It's a specific fat from the beef, and it's the fat from around the kidneys, which means it's a very special fat. And what I love about suet is that you don't have to render it. It has this kind of papery skin, and you peel that off, and you can just grate it. So I recommend it to people who are pastry novices. Mm-hmm. So there's no rubbing in the butter. It's not fiddly, no rubbing in the lard. You can just stir the grated suet into the flour, and you'll make a pastry that's extremely light and rich at the same time. So if you've never used suet before and you can get your hands on it, my suggestion is to make a scone or a tea biscuit. Mm-hmm. Take out the butter and put the suet in and see what happens.
Okay, still in that same category of something that I think of as being very British, but we're not familiar with, dripping. Dripping.
It's not the most attractive name, actually, but, you know, it's just the dripping from the roast. When you cook a nice standing rib roast, the fat melts and drips down into the pan.
Right.
So that's the dripping. But dripping is really a little bit more than fat. Dripping is fat, and that if you tip the fat off your roast into a little jar,
right,
you'll know it sets. The fat will set on the top, but underneath there'll be this wonderful meaty flavored jelly. And that We always, as kids, like the next day after the roast, it was even better because we'd cut slices of the cold roast and we'd spread that dripping and the jelly onto the bread and make the most wonderful sandwiches. It is really delicious. And, of course, that jelly, too, is something that you can add into a sauce or a gravy because it's full of meaty flavor.
Yeah.
And I think of it as being beef dripping, but the dripping can come off a chicken. It can come off a pork roast. It can come off any cut of meat that you're cooking, roasting like that in the oven. And I think people tend to tip that out and throw it away, mm-hmm. or they keep a little bit to make their gravy. And I want them to tip it into a jar and use it again, like to enrich a sauce or maybe enrich a chicken soup even.
How about some really quick tips, little ways, a little bit of fat that has a lot of flavor and how to use it?
Well, let's say butter, for example. If you've just made that roast chicken or if you've pan fried something and you've got the juices in the pan, if you just whisk in a tablespoon or two of butter into those juices, you'll make yourself a wonderful, rich, savory, great tasting sauce without it being particularly fatty. It'll just be luscious and velvety and tasty. Or you can put a bit of duck fat into your cooked cabbage. Wonderful way to enrich cooked cabbage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And bacon fat, you know, don't waste that after you've cooked some wonderful bacon for breakfast. Perhaps you could pour that over some vegetables or even use it to make a salad dressing or bacon mayonnaise. You know, because you just usually make that with an olive oil or a vegetable oil.
Right.
But if the bacon fat is liquid, it makes a wonderful mayonnaise, and it's great for a BLT.
Hey, Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Canadian food writer Jennifer McLaughlin is author of Fat, An Appreciation of a Misunderstood Ingredient with Recipes. Now, one of the other fats we tend to overlook is salt pork. Now, it's quite easy to use once you get some of the basics down. It's sold in blocks. I always look for ones with streaks of lean meat in them. Now, before you toss it in the fry pan, it's best to cut it up and drop it in boiling water for a couple of minutes. This is called blanching, and it gets rid of excess salt, and it gives you more of that really good pork taste. Okay, so now let's talk actual dishes. Well, it can be as simple as sautéing a little bit of salt pork with any vegetable. Add water and broth and just cook until the vegetable is tender. They're going to be absolutely delicious. Now, another classic approach is a pasta. You dice up the salt pork. You cook it with a little bit of olive oil. You add garlic, lots of black pepper, wilt in some spinach, and toss that with bow tie pasta. The cheese is optional. Now, for a French take on a main dish, sauté the salt pork slowly, let it release its fat, and do that with some bay leaves, some cloves, orange zest, and thyme. Add tomatoes, boil them down to a sauce, and then stir in cooked beans or lentils. Now, to ramp things up even more, you could make salt pork quite easily at home, and it's much tastier than the supermarket variety. Well, conveniently, Jennifer left us with a recipe for homemade salt pork to get started. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Britain's wine ace, Jancis Robinson, and the great garlicky greens eating contest. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Mars. For generations, Mars has been making chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. More information and tips to help you make healthy decisions can be found at MarsHealthyLiving.com. I sometimes wonder if extraordinary expertise can only come to people who fall in love. Now, I mean, head over heels in love with a subject. Obsessed is probably another word for this. Now, I think this is what might have happened to British wine writer Jancis Robinson. First, a couple of years ago, I was taken by her book, How to Taste Wine. Then I learned that in Britain, she's considered to be one of the most powerful people in the world of wine. Well, it turns out that through her years of TV shows, columns, and over 22 books, she's practically taught a generation to understand wine. Her latest tome is the revered Oxford Companion to Wine. Jancis Robinson, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So, Jancis, what was the draw of wine? What got you into it?
I think think greed, really.
Really?
I loved food. I still love food. And it's just a short step from loving the taste of food to loving the taste of wine and realizing how well wine goes with food. But there was one specific wine, and I think this happens for a lot of people who end up devoting their lives to wine, that there is just one wine that lights the fire. And for me, it was being taken out for dinner when I was at Oxford to a little restaurant outside Oxford. And my boyfriend of that time's father was very generous, so he had quite a good budget. And
this is so important when you're
I remember we had a red Burgundy, Chambol Musigny Les Amoureuses, 1959. And it was just so much better than Student Blanc. You know, just one sniff of it was, you know, all enveloping. And I think it made me realize that here was something that was not just hugely pleasurable in a sort of sensual way, but somehow I sensed there was a lot of backstory to it as well, you know, history and geography and all that kind of thing. So that lit the flame. But when I graduated, you wouldn't believe this, but certainly in this country, and I suspect in America too, wine and food didn't have anything like the prestige that they have today. I mean, my friends would have thought that it would have been a frivolous thing to do, to have wasted my education.
So when was this? When was this?
A long time ago.
The earth was cooling, yes.
Early 70s. And really, there was a lot of Puritanism about food and drink. Very, very different to today. Very different.
So how did you actually start?
I dropped out to Provence, to a little village or within sort of spitting distance, really, of where Peter Mayle would arrive a couple of years later and write that book, A Year in Provence, and make his fortune. I was only there for a year. And, of course, about 3 minutes in France is enough to make you realise that here is a culture for whom eating and drinking are, you know, the most important things in life. So I rid myself of that hang-up about food and wine not being a decent thing to earn your living in, and was determined that when I got back to London, I would find a job in either one or the other. And the one that happened to come up first was assistant editor of a wine trade magazine with a tiny circulation, so I could make all sorts of mistakes that nobody noticed. And I just took it from there, did the exams, wrote a book, got a column, wrote more books, got another column, you know, made television programs. I was very, very lucky about the timing. But I was also born on a Saturday, and Saturday's child works hard for their living, and I'm cursed with that.
Well, we're looking at a period now, and I have no doubt England's affected the way we are, of really difficult financial times. What do you think this is going to do to the wine world?
Well, it's already having the effect of bringing prices of the very, very top trophy wines tumbling down, which is great because they were at completely silly prices. At the bottom end, there is much more activity on the part of retailers. They're really screwing their suppliers, certainly in this country, that's for sure. I mean, they were never generous. Oh, they're rewriting their terms of payment. You know, we said we'd pay you in 60 days, but we've decided we'll pay you in 120, you know, that kind of thing.
Boy, it's tough.
It is tough. It's very tough. And it's going to get very tough, certainly for Britain, with this horribly weak pound. And I don't think the dollar's doing all that much better, considering that so many of the world's most famous wines are made in the Eurozone, and the euro is just getting stronger and stronger. One effect has already been that South Africa's doing very well because its currency hasn't moved so dramatically in the wrong direction. So that's a great place for inexpensive whites in particular. And I think we will all be trading down. And there's, you know, that's no bad thing. There are so many well-made wines that don't cost a fortune now. I mean, I so often I've tasted through the range of a producer, and you know, they've got their regular bottling, and then they've got their special bottling that's got a bit more new oak on it, and then they've got their super special, or they sometimes call it icon wine, you know, which is they've made it because to last for 40 years. Who's going to be around for 40 years, you know? And it's horrible when it's young, and all you're paying for is sort of some vague unfulfilled promise. So often the regular bottlings can give so much more pleasure than the super ambitious ones that are really just a sort of gleam in the eye of the winemaker, that I don't think it's so bad if everything's going to regularise a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as I say, I think South Africa has a surplus of white grapes and a long history of making very competent, fresh, fairly simple, but mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. nicely balanced dry white wines, especially from their Chenin Blanc grape, which tends to be a lot more interesting than, say, the average California Chenin Blanc. And I think Chile offers very good value at the bottom end. I mean, it may not be the most distinctive wine in the world. There's a mm-hmm. huge clump of wine that tastes very, very similar. But we certainly see a lot of really well-made, very fruity, very satisfying Chilean red wine, and increasingly good quality, good value whites mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. Then Spain has, you know, Spain is the country with the biggest area of vineyards in the world. And as a result of that, can offer some great buys in, especially Garnacha. They've got a lot of Garnacha, same as Grenache.
Yes,
bush vines, very concentrated because they've got a terrible shortage of water, so the grapes are small and there's bags of flavour packed into each one. So I'd nominate Spanish red as a great buy, unless you go for one of the names that's been sort of written up in all the guides that everyone has been paying silly prices for.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've really got to look for where has a surplus of grapes. And of course, two obvious places are the Languedoc-Roussillon in the south of France, which just has far too many vineyards and not enough customers. There are some lovely, really characterful, single family-owned domain-produced wines there. Again, for the same reason as Spain, not much water, so thick-skinned grapes, lots of character. And Puglia, way in the heel of Italy, that's got a surplus of wine, so there's very good value there as well.
This is great. Gensis, thanks so much for talking with us.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Wine writer Gensis Robinson is editor of the Oxford Companion to Wine. Now, if you find yourself with a nice bottle of red, let's say a Zinfandel or maybe a Malbec from Argentina, it would go well with my meatless Golden Celebration Pie of Winter Vegetables. You can find the recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. John Willoughby has a great job. He's executive editor of Gourmet Magazine. Now, among other responsibilities, this job means that he covers not only food here in the United States, but also around the world. John, good to have you back.
It's great to be here, Lynn.
You know, John, you look at the way political and economic change has changed food scenes. I'm thinking of Russia, for instance, and the former Soviet Union. And I know there have been some political changes in Istanbul, and
yes,
it's
indeed
always been a great food city. But have you seen that affect the food scene?
Well, you know, Istanbul is now a mega city with about 11 million people. So like every giant city in the world, it's got a whole range of modern, trendy food and a European food mm-hmm. and every kind mm-hmm. of food you want. But it has also still got a lot of traditional restaurants. And there are two factors about these restaurants that make them great. One is you have to decide what you want to eat before you go to the restaurant because they specialize. There are meat restaurants, fish restaurants, taverns. There are separate places where you get baklava and where you get milk desserts, separate shops.
Huh.
So you have to know what you want before you go. And the other thing is whether they serve alcohol or not is a huge factor. So the ones that serve alcohol cater to the sort of secularist part of the population, mm-hmm. and those that do not cater to the pious Muslim part of the population. So you not only get interesting food, you get a sort of interesting cultural insight when you go to these places too.
So there are actually, for instance, Muslim restaurants or Christian restaurants.
There are restaurants that don't serve alcohol. Mostly those are what are called locantas, which are sort of, they used to be kind of working person's restaurants. Mm-hmm. They serve the kind of food that women made at home, mothers typically made at home, pot roast and things made in casseroles generally is what they made. And they still do that, and none of them serve alcohol. Well, very few of them serve alcohol. And on the other end of the sort of spectrum are what are called mahanis. These are taverns, and they were started by Europeans during the Ottoman regime. And they are places where you go to eat. First, you have hot appetizers, cold appetizers. Then you mm-hmm. have fish, always served with raki, the sort of national drink of Turkey.
Right.
And mainly, they're places where you go to have fellowship. Richard Burton, the British explorer, described them as places where you get intoxicated because of a sense of comradeship, not necessarily because of the alcohol.
Uh-huh.
And they still, you can go there and you'll end up staying till 2:30 in the morning, and everyone will be singing. They're really sort of lively tavern kind of places, and they still do exist.
That sounds great for people who want to get to know local people and feel very cut off
great.
Being tourists.
Absolutely. I mean, as I said, you can find anything there, but these traditional restaurants are really the best. And then there are the meat restaurants where they tend to serve kofta, kebabs, that kind of traditional
right.
Anatolian food. Fish restaurants, always on the Bosporus or overlooking the Bosporus, where they do not serve any meat. And then the thing that I think is the most kind of endearing is that if you want baklava, you go to this restaurant, and if you want milk-based desserts, you go somewhere else.
That was the thing that intrigued me, milk-based desserts.
Puddings, served, basically.
Aha, but served in a separate restaurant.
Yep. They do serve a little food, but mostly you go there just to get the puddings.
Do you go restaurant hopping when you're in Istanbul?
I'm going to go next week, and I certainly plan to go to all the places in this article.
Because I'm thinking about, you could go to the bar and have some nibbles and sing.
Right.
And then you could go and have your fish course and then your meat course, and you could have a little nibble of baklava, and you could end with a milk dessert, which will help your tummy to go to bed.
There you go. It's like the ultimate progressive dinner.
Yes.
Oh, it's great.
Hey, John, have a great trip.
Thank you, Lynn. I think I will.
John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine. The article on traditional restaurants in Istanbul appeared in the October 2008 issue of Gourmet. Now, you can find some of his Istanbul restaurant picks, where? On the website, splendidtable.org. So, yes, the Super Bowl is a big deal. But if you want to see prime athletes at the top of their game, if you want to see awesome action, get thee to an eating competition. That is where the age-old human dramas are played out in real time, as Rebecca Shear reports.
It's kind of like the story of David and Goliath, only instead of armor and a shield bearer, this Goliath comes armed with a stomach that can bear 19 and a half hot dogs eaten in 10 minutes.
5.5 pounds of burritos in 10 minutes. 5 pounds of ramen noodles in 10 minutes. And 32 crystal hamburgers in 8 minutes.
These are just some of the personal records of Pete Pretty Boy DeVicus.
I am a professional competitor of the eating discipline.
A Boston native.
I've heard you guys referred to as professional gurgitators.
Who's ranked 25th. In the competitive eating world.
Yeah, I was going to use that term. I just decided to switch it up a little bit.
Pretty Boy has been competing for 2 years.
It's my sport. Some guys golf on different courses. I eat different courses.
The course he's eating today is more of an appetizer. Sort of. It's garlic sautéed spinach, known here at local fast food eatery Be Good as garlicky greens. And the 6'1", 215-pound gurgitator will have 5 minutes to bolt down as much as he can in Be Good's 5th annual Garlicky Greens Eating Contest.
What are you aiming for today? What's your goal in terms of poundage of spinach?
As long as it's an ounce more than the next guy, I don't care.
One of those next guys, by the way, is this guy.
My name is Betsy's Boy, also known as Michael Cobb.
And at 5'10", 155 pounds.
I am of medium build, to be generous.
The undergraduate business student is far more David.
Have you done any other competitive eating competitions of any sort?
Then Goliath.
I haven't, actually.
Not that Betsy's Boy is a total newbie. Last year, he guzzled a record-breaking 3.25 pounds of garlicky greens.
Beating the closest contender by over 0.5 pound.
Earning himself the title of world champion.
And my prize was this exceptional Be Good wrestling belt and a year's worth of free burgers.
But that was back when the contest was amateur hour, or amateur 5 minutes, as the case may be. But this year?
I got an email from one of the pros who said, I want a shot at the title. What do I have to do?
The pro, as it happens, was one Pete Pretty Boy DeVicus. And turns out he didn't have to do anything. The one who did was this fellow.
John Olinto. I'm the co-founder of Be Good.
And in order for any pros to compete, John had to get the contest officially sanctioned.
We had to go through Major League Eating, which is this international confederation of eaters, right?
Right. A sports franchise, really, which oversees all professional eating events. And as such,
you need to have a stage.
There are certain rules.
You need an MC from Major League Eating.
You even need an EMT in case of, I kid you not,
stomach injury, esophagus damage, whatever it might be.
So John and his co-founder, Anthony Ackle, took care of all that and approached their customers and said,
listen, we have pros coming in to try to take what's ours, which is our family's belt. You know, like, we're a family. You have to defend our honor.
And 8 members of the Be Good family have shown up to defend that honor today.
It is a battle of the ages, people. And it happens here, today, at this place, Be Good Real Food Real Fest.
They're competing against Pete Davikas and Mike Springer, who's known for downing 80 chicken wings in 8 minutes.
We gather now upon the Mount Sinai of mastication, the Madison Square Garden of Gurgitation. So it is, and so it shall be! That's when you cheer.
Outside the restaurant, before an obviously awestruck crowd, the eaters take their marks behind 2 tables, each piled with 1-pound plates of garlicky greens. At the MC's signal,
3, 2, 1, begin eating!
They dig in, using their bare hands to shovel spinach into their mouths, and in some cases onto the eater next to them. Betsy's boy makes a valiant effort.
How is the defending champ doing? He's finishing, he's third.
But compared with Pretty Boy,
he's on 7.
There's not much he can do except
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, stop eating! Stop eating! Stop eating!
In the end, Pretty Boy nabs first place with 7 pounds of spinach. Mike Springer places second with 5. And after polishing off a respectable 4 1/3 pounds,
which is 33% growth over 1 year,
Michael, Betsy's boy, Cobb,
you are a business student, aren't you?
Ties for 3rd.
We try.
And he's more than ready to try again next year, he says. In the meantime, it appears this devouring David,
so physically right now, how you feeling?
I'm okay.
Might be ready to trade his slingshot for a stomach of steel.
Word has it that Pete is going out for pizza now.
I think I'll pass on that. I might do a burger. Pizza I'll pass on.
Well, almost anyway. For The Splendid Table, I'm Rebecca Shear in Cambridge.
Now for your very own competitive greens, get our recipe for melting greens. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now the question is, how fast can a champagne cork fly? But we're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we will be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Mars. For generations, Mars has been making chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. More information and tips to help you make healthy decisions can be found at MarsHealthyLiving.com. Now, we're going to be talking to you in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252, or you can email us, splendidtable.org. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, how fast can a champagne cork fly? Top speed would be 62 miles an hour. Now, that is if the bottle is left to warm in the sun. Now, if instead you merely shake the bottle and let the cork rip, you will only get to 24.8 miles an hour. Now, this is all from a German scientist named Friedrich Balick. Now, he is at the Clausthal Technical University in Germany and possibly looking for a job right now. The story came out in Britain's Decanter magazine. Now, for the magazine's science-minded readers, much information was lacking. They raised questions like, what were the exact temperatures of each bottle? Was this true champagne or just a fizzy wine not produced in the traditional way? And finally, and I love this one, was the question, was it a vintage or non-vintage champagne? The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. 52-52. Anything goes. Okay, let's see. Who's calling? We have got Dawn on the line from Bemidji, Minnesota. Dawn, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm looking for ideas for using fresh coconut. I buy lots of coconut and use the shell, but I need some ideas for using the fresh coconut, in particular appetizers.
Wait a minute. Let's back up a minute. What do you do with the shell?
I carve into the shell. That's something I learned while I was in Mexico. And so I have lots of coconut and coconut shell laying around, but I don't really know what to do with the coconut meat.
Oh, you can do a ton of things with it.
Good.
Yeah. Good, she says, because I've got all this coconut meat. Well, you know it freezes well. You probably learned that one. It does hold up well, but there's a couple of things. First of all, you can make fresh coconut milk, which we normally buy in cans. And fresh coconut milk is really fabulous. And the way you do that is throw the coconut into the food processor,
okay,
with some very hot water. And I'd say, oh, let's say you have a half a cup of coconut. I'd add a cup of hot water.
Okay.
And puree it. And then let it sit for a half hour or so. Strain it, pressing out all you can from that coconut. And you will get this really lovely coconut milk, which tastes of the coconut. And then when you make a curry, you make any dish where you need to add any kind of flavored liquid, mm-hmm. you can add that coconut milk. And if you make it with less liquid, it becomes coconut cream. Now, another thing you can do with fresh coconut is that you can thin slice it, or again, in the food processor, using a slicing blade, you know, get chips of it. Mm-hmm. And you can just toast them in the oven.
Okay.
And then that's just great to snack on. But you could also toss that with a little bit of sugar and chili, okay, and salt. And lightly toast it in the oven.
Okay.
And the sugar will caramelize a little bit.
That sounds good.
Yeah. And then you just nibble on that as a snack. Or you use that sprinkled with lime juice, fresh lime.
Okay.
All right. And you could put that on little chips. You could put that, you know, toss that with fresh pineapple or even canned pineapple at this time of year. Or fresh mango. And you have a lovely salad, onion. You see, I mean, it could also go on top of a coconut custard pie.
I don't bake pies.
All right. Well, coconut custard pudding.
Oh, very good.
Or you could, again, top something like a big pot of curried chicken mm-hmm. with that blend.
Now, what if a recipe calls for sweetened coconut and I have fresh coconut?
Well, all you do then is you shred it. You know, in a processor or
sure.
whatever, and you toss it with a bit of sugar.
Oh, that's simple?
It.
Okay.
That's simple. And some people like to bake it lightly, you know, to help it permeate.
Mm-hmm.
You could even, to keep it from browning, because in some recipes you don't want it crisped, you could sort of wrap it in foil and then put it in a low oven and let the sugar permeate a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, the sweetening the coconut is an industrial process. And it permeates the coconut more than maybe we can do in a home kitchen. But essentially, it is the idea that you toss the coconut with the sweetening.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I can't wait to put it in the oven with the chili and the salt. That sounds wonderful.
And sugar, because
yeah,
you want that
sugar.
Balance. It's really a nice combination. And do remember, just taking it out of the shell and throwing it in the freezer, you'll have it, and you can then deal with it when you want to deal with it.
Good idea.
So are you an artist? You work with the coconut shell?
Well, I do, yeah. I work with macrame and coconut shell, and this weekend we have a arts tour where people will be coming to my home to watch the process of using the coconut shell. So I thought it would be especially nice to have some fresh coconut dishes out for them to nibble on while they...
Oh, that's a lovely idea. You could do those chips. It would be great.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm going to do.
Dawn, thank you for
calling.
Oh,
thank you so much.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. And let's see, we have got Anne calling from Philadelphia. Anne, what can I do for you?
Hi there, how are you?
I am good.
Oh, I'm hoping you can help me. I went in college as a freshman, tasted just what to me, very simple little college kid with no sort of, you know, very wet behind the ears, no real huge culinary experience, was served a dessert called Rumtopf at the home of college professors. had taught my dad years before.
Uh-huh.
And I thought I had died and gone to heaven. And, you know, it was room tough. And I Googled the internet, came up with a pot, but no recipe. And I, you know,
really?
It's 30 years later, and I'm still thinking about this dessert.
You know, I was just about to say, was that in the 70s?
Yeah, 78.
Yeah, because it was a big deal then. And I have a feeling this is really old. This is what it is. Rumtopf, and you can buy the special sort of, they're like ceramic jars, tall jars.
Right.
But you can do this in almost anything. I'm not sure if it began in Germany, but it's a German name. And the idea was that you took fresh fruit as it came on the market and you cut it up. You peeled it and you cut it up and you put it into this big jar or crock. And whatever the weight of the fruit, you had an equal weight of sugar to go with the fruit.
Okay.
And you would cover it with rum.
As you go.
As you went. So if you started in May, the Rumtopf would be ideal at Christmas. Because
I think that's when I had it.
Yeah, maybe so. But the idea was that in May you started with, let's say, berries. And then you went to, you know, whatever came in season next, melon and peaches. But it works usually best with firmer fruits like apples, pears, peaches, nectarines, you know, cherries, that kind of thing.
Okay.
So you layer whatever the weight of the fruit, you layer in and cover that fruit with sugar.
Okay.
And then you make sure that there's rum covering everything by about a half inch to an inch.
Okay, half an inch. Okay.
Yeah, and you lightly cover it because there's a fermentation process going on here.
Yeah, I think she kept it in a jar on her stairs to the basement.
Some people, for safety's sake, keep it in the refrigerator.
Okay.
And you want to use a high-proof rum because you just want to be super sure it's safe.
And how, when you say high proof, white or
it could be white or dark. White rum is probably a good idea because of the colors of the fruits.
Okay.
You know, you'll just see the fruits better.
Okay.
But you want a pretty high proof.
Okay.
Higher than 80 even.
Okay.
And I mean, I'm playing it very safe here, mm-hmm. just to be sure. Do you remember it as being pretty potent?
Well, we're talking college freshman who probably was newly introduced to lots of alcohols, but I just remember this incredible color and bursting fruit flavor and just, it was pretty high proof, but it was,
was fabulous, right?
Oh, yeah.
Really, if you start it in late spring and run through the summer,
mm-hmm.
and you can keep this going for a very, very long time.
Yeah, I'm sure hers was developed for years.
Just thou shalt not seal the jar.
Okay, because that creates bacteria problems.
And it also can create explosive problems depending on what's happening in the jar.
That would be pretty ugly.
Yeah, it could get really nasty.
And a waste of good fruit.
So give it a shot.
Okay, thank you so
much. You are welcome.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was what they call a blast from the past. The 70s, this was a huge deal, and there were all of these recipes. You could put it over cake and all of these other things. Never underestimate the power of sugar, rum, and anything that you put in that combination. Anyway, 800-537-5252. That's how you can reach us. And we have got Ann Lacey calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Ann, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I wanted to talk about what I can do with my winter vegetables from our CSA that we receive. We've been getting a lot of sweet potatoes and acorn squash, more than I can handle, and just didn't know if there's a way to freeze them and preserve them for later use.
Freezing them just straight out gets messy because they generally break down. But what you can do is you can cook them and then freeze the flesh, and then you can use it any number of ways. But, you know, one thing does occur to me, that business about stuffing acorn squash, you know, pre-baking it and then stuffing it with something interesting. I'll bet you could do that and then freeze the whole thing.
Okay. So would you suggest roasting or
roasting
the sweet potatoes as well?
Yeah, I would do roasting only because it just intensifies flavor.
Okay. And keep the peel on them.
This is what I would do.
Okay.
With the sweet potatoes, I'd roast them. When they're done, let them cool down, slit them all the way down, scoop out all the flesh, put the flesh in one container. And then are these organic, by the way?
They are.
Great. Okay. Scrub them before you bake them.
Okay.
I take those skins, and what I do is I brush them with olive oil and coarse salt and run them under the broiler.
Okay.
And I eat them.
I love that. That sounds great.
Yeah, I mean, why not?
Okay.
But the flesh, it'll separate a little bit. The moisture will separate a little bit in the freezing. You just beat it up and you're done when you defrost it. With the acorn squash, you could do the same thing. But then again, the acorn squash, you could also just have roast it, you know, brush it with a little oil and salt, give it a roast, stuff it with something that's fun, and then freeze that.
Sounds great.
Yeah, I think you should be in good shape.
That sounds great.
Okay, you take care.
Thank you so much.
You take care. Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. You know, one of the things you can do with either one of those things, these sweet squashes or sweet potatoes, is cut them into chunks and toss them with things like chunks of celery, Brussels sprouts, anything from the cabbage family, because it's a great contrast. And then slow roast them, 325, give them a couple hours until they're almost melting and caramelized too. And that would be just delicious. And you can eat that hot or at room temperature. And if it's small enough, you can put it on picks and just have it with drinks. Hot cider with a little bit of caramelized sweet potato, not a bad thing. Call us, 800-537-5252. Phil Lempert is a predictor, a trend researcher who tracks supermarkets. He's called the supermarket guru, and he's been tracking some of the significant changes in how our food is being sold. Phil, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So, Phil, how is our food shopping changing?
Well, we as shoppers, especially now in these tough economic times, are shopping smarter than ever before. We're using coupons, we're using shopping lists, and we're actually shopping the entire store. For example, when we used to go to the fresh seafood department, mm-hmm. now we're going to the frozen seafood department. And some of the surprises are that a lot of those other products, like frozen seafood,
yeah.
not only are you going to save 30 or 40%, but it's going to be better quality. And people are surprised as they're finding that instead of paying $5 for half a pint of blueberries that are out of season, mm-hmm. going to the frozen food case, you can get four times as much for only about $2. And they were actually picked at the peak of freshness, so there's more nutrition and more flavor. So frozen foods, really, this year, we've seen huge increases. We're going to continue to see huge increases next year. And it's coming at a time where supermarkets are actually getting smaller in size.
Smaller in size?
Walmart, Tesco's Fresh and Easy, Albertson, and Safeway have all announced and have rolled out stores that are between 10 and 15,000 square foot. The average store now is just over 45,000 square foot. So what that means is about two-thirds of the products that are on the shelves now, they're going to disappear. So these brands are really putting their best foot forward to meet the needs that you and I as a consumer have. It's all about value, it's about health and nutrition, mm-hmm. and certainly it's about mm-hmm. taste.
Are we going to see a lot of fresh things disappear then?
I don't think so, but I think we are going to see less fresh. And what I mean by that is I think we're going to move to the more local and locale trends.
Huh.
So we might not see 400 varieties of produce, of which 300 of them might be imported from other countries, we're going to see 50 to 100 varieties that are domestic, that might be grown by Sam the farmer down the block, or might be grown, you know, in California, but it's going to be identified as such.
That's very, so you think this great interest in local is going to hold with this economy?
Oh, definitely. Local is hot and growing. The extension of local is locale. Again, where we know where these products come from,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
even if it's not within 100 miles, it's still in a place that we, you know, want
we
our
can,
food to come from.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think at the risk of organic. Organic has just gotten so expensive that people, and by the way, there's not enough of a supply of organic,
mm-hmm.
so people are really starting to think twice about why they're buying organic and finding alternatives to that.
Is convenience still the main thing that is driving people, or do you think that there's a shift there?
Major shift. I don't think that we're willing to pay for convenience anymore. I also think that we've discovered that what a manufacturer might have thought is convenient isn't. There is an exception. Again, back to the frozen food case, if you take a look at the new innovation this past year from technology about steaming, this has been brilliant. We're
mm-hmm.
finally using our microwave to do more than just microwave popcorn and boil water. The steaming technology that Bird's Eye, that Healthy Choice, that some of the pasta companies have used is great. So I think when it comes to convenience, yes. When it comes to frozen foods, no. When it comes to prepared foods in the supermarket, mm-hmm. Because, again, we want to know where our food comes from. We want to know, frankly, you know, what all the ingredients are, what the cooking directions mm-hmm. are. And we're mm-hmm. not getting that from a lot of the prepared foods in our supermarket.
Well, it looks like America may go back to cooking. What a great idea.
I'm not sure if it's cooking, but assembling. You know, sophisticated assembly is the best that I could hope for, which is okay. I mean, if I could steam a bag of vegetables, steam something else, and, mm-hmm. and put mm-hmm. it all together, yep. that's okay. It's better than we have now.
I have very high hopes.
Phil, I'm with you. I'll keep my fingers crossed.
Phil, thanks for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Consumer advocate Phil Lembert calls himself the supermarket guru. Now, for more information, you can go to our website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Dennis Miller, who said, "You really have bad eating habits if you use a grocery cart in the 7-Eleven." The Splendid Table is distributed by American Public Media. Now, for information on underwriting our program or other APM programs such as Speaking of Faith, visit AmericanPublicMedia.org. Information on nearly everything you heard here today can be found on our website, SplendidTable.org. Have a visit. You're going to find podcasts, newsletters, a recipe archive from our very talented and opinionated guests, and information on our book, How to Eat Supper. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lupke. Our website is managed by Ryan Van Ness. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. You have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.